The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
And then she said, "But you never slept without your teddy bear before. How will you feel sleeping without your teddy bear for the very first time? I'll feel fine. I'll feel great. I will probably love sleeping without my teddy bear. Just don't worry about it," I say. "Who's worry?" she said. But now, she had me thinking about it. Now she really had me thinking about it. I began to wonder, suppose I won't like sleeping without my teddy bear. Suppose I just hate sleeping without my teddy bear. Should I take him? "Take him," said my mother. "Take him," said my father. "But Reggie will laugh," I said. "He'll say I'm a baby." "He won't laugh," said my mother. "He won't laugh," said my father. "He'll laugh," said my sister. I decided not to take my teddy bear. That afternoon, I played with Reggie. Reggie had plans, big plans. "Tonight," he said, "when you come to my house, we are going to have fun, fun, fun. First, I'll show you my junk collection, and after that, we'll have a wrestling match, and after that, a pillow fight, and after that, we'll do magic tricks, and after that, we'll play checkers, and after that, we'll play dominoes, and after that, we can fool around with my magnifying glass." "Great," I said, "I can hardly wait." "By the way," I asked, "what do you think of teddy bears?" But Reggie just went on talking and planning as if he had never heard of teddy bears. "And after that," he said, "do you know what we can do after that? I mean, when the lights are out and the house is really dark. Guess what we can do?" "What?" I asked. "We can tell ghost stories." "Ghost stories?" I asked. "Ghost stories," said Reggie. "Scary, creepy, spooky ghost stories." I began to think about my teddy bear. "Does your house get very dark?" I asked. "Uh-huh," said Reggie. "Very, very dark?" "Uh-huh," said Reggie. "By the way," I said again, "what do you think of teddy bears?" Suddenly, Reggie was in a big hurry to go someplace. "See you tonight," he said. "See you," I said. I decided to take my teddy bear. "Good," said my mother. "Good," said my father. But my sister said, "What if Reggie wants to know your teddy bear's name? Did you think about that? And did you think about how he will laugh and say Tata is a silly baby name, even for a teddy bear?" "He won't ask," I said. "He'll ask," she said. I decided not to take my teddy bear. At last, it was time to go to Reggie's house. "Good night," said my mother. "Good night," said my father. "Sleep tight," said my sister. I went next door where Reggie lived. That night, Reggie showed me his junk. He showed me his flashlight, his collection of bottle caps, a chain made of chewing gum wrappers, some picture postcards, an egg timer, jumbo goggles, a false nose and mustache, and a bunch of old rubber stamps and labels from his father's office. We decided to play office with the rubber stamps. After that, we had a wrestling match. And after that, we had a pillow fight. And after that, Reggie's father said, "Bedtime." "Already?" said Reggie. "Already," said his father. We got into bed. "Good night," said Reggie's father. "Good night," we said. Reggie sighed. I sighed. "We can still tell ghost stories," said Reggie. "Do you know any?" I asked. "Uh-huh," said Reggie. Reggie began to tell a ghost story. Once, there was this ghost, and he lived in a haunted house, only he did most of the haunting himself. This house was empty, except for this ghost, because nobody wanted to go near this house, and they were so afraid of this ghost, and every night this ghost would walk around this house and make all kinds of clunky, creaky sounds, oomph, oomph, like that. And he would go around looking for people to scare because that's what he liked most to do, scare people. And he was very scary to look at. Oh, was he scary to look at. Reggie stopped. "Are you scared?" he asked. "Uh-huh," I said. Are you?" "What?" said Reggie. "Are you scared?" "Just a minute," said Reggie. "I have to get something." "What do you have to get?" I asked. "Oh, something," said Reggie. Reggie pulled the something out of a drawer. The room was dark, but I could see it had fuzzy arms and legs and was about the size of a teddy bear. I looked again. It was a teddy bear. Reggie got back into bed. "Now, about this ghost," he said. "Is that your teddy bear?" I asked. "What?" said Reggie. "Is that your teddy bear? You mean this teddy bear? The one you're holding," I said. "Uh-huh," Reggie answered. "What, do you sleep with him all the time?" "What?" said Reggie. "Do you sleep with him all the time?" "Uh-huh." "Does your teddy bear have a name?" "Does your teddy bear have a name?" I said louder. "Uh-huh," Reggie answered. "What is it?" "You won't laugh?" said Reggie. "No, I won't laugh," I said. "Promise?" "I promise. It's Fufu." "Did you say Fufu?" "Uh-huh," said Reggie. "Just a minute," I said. "I have to get something." "What do you have to get?" Reggie asked. "Oh, something," I answered. The next minute, I was ringing my own doorbell. The door opened. "Ira," everyone said. "What are you doing here?" "I changed my mind," I answered. "You what?" said my mother. "You what?" said my father. "You what?" said my sister. She was still up. "I changed my mind," I said. "I decided to take Tata after all." I went upstairs. Soon I was down again with Tata. My sister said, "Reggie will laugh. You'll see how he'll laugh. He'll just fall down laughing." "He won't laugh," said my mother. "He won't laugh," said my father. "He won't laugh," I said. I came back to Reggie's room. "I have a teddy bear too," I said. "Do you want to know his name?" I waited for Reggie to say, "Uh-huh." But Reggie didn't say, "Uh-huh." Reggie didn't say anything. I looked at Reggie. He was fast asleep. Just like that, he had fallen asleep. "Reggie, wake up," I said. "You have to finish telling the ghost story." But Reggie just held his teddy bear closer and went right on sleeping. And after that, well, there wasn't anything to do after that. "Good night," I whispered to Tata, and I fell asleep too. So what makes a good children's story? From what I hear, you've been critiquing these things all week. Any comments on what made that a good story? Okay, conflict came on pretty fast, didn't it? Anyone else? Yeah. What about the writer's style? That has to do with that, doesn't it? What's unique about his style? The way he writes. Has to do with Anthony's comment there. Okay. Right. There was a certain amount of continuity there. It's also a lot of short sentences, very short, and yet it flowed very well. Any other comments? Okay, thank you.
I perceived that we were all paying attention to that children's story. We have a lot to do today. Probably won't get it all done, but we have tomorrow to finish it, so we're not going to worry about that. We want to do some reading ourselves today. We haven't done that much. I reread your comments about what you expected to get out of it, and it reinforced again that how many of you, the majority, said they liked reading, to hear a reading modeled, and you certainly heard an excellent example of that. Before I forget, on the table back there in the foyer, there's an evaluation sheet, and the top part of it has to do with faith builders in general, and the bottom part of it has to do with this class. I would appreciate it if you would fill it out. And it gives me the opportunity to mention, it's nice, it has a section under suggested improvements and strengths of this workshop. You know, as teachers, we need to be able to take criticism. And that's really how we learned the most. Now, obviously, if you enjoyed the class and you feel like you got your money's worth, it would be nice to know that. But it would also be nice to know what in your opinion, what we could do to improve it. And we need to learn to take that criticism and grow by it. We tell children, when you're critiquing what they do, whether it's reading, writing, whatever it is, that they need to learn to take criticism and grow by it. But many times as adults, we have a hard time doing that. And I would even venture to say it'd be possible for you to put a comment down there that will hurt my feelings. But that doesn't mean that it isn't a good comment for me to hear. Isn't that right? That's right. So be very free with that and leave it back there in the foyer anywhere. And Milo, I'm sure, would appreciate you completing this evaluation. First thing that I want to do is read you a story about Read Me a Story. This appeared in 1992, and it's something that speaks in here of one point that I hadn't thought about, and I'm going to take time to read this whole article. I heard this lady speak recently, and she mentioned many times when a child goo-goos, a baby, a very little child, we don't always respond, and we think that it's inappropriate for an adult to say goo-goo, or whatever the child does, the noise they make. And she pointed out, and I think she's right, it's important for us, at whatever level the child is, the communication that they have with an adult, they need to hear the adult repeat that, so they know that that communication is okay. So it's important when a little baby goo-goos that you goo-goo back at them. That's reinforcement for them that they're doing okay. And you can follow that all through their life. I thought that was a neat thought. It encourages them to communicate. When they make those little noises when they're babies, they're communicating with you, aren't they? And they need to know that that's acceptable. That's good. Each night before he goes to bed, David 3 of River Edge, New Jersey, toddles over to the lower shelf in his room, pulls out a book he wants his parents, Andrea, a lawyer, and Michael, a businessman, to read to him. Sometimes David picks his children's Bible with its colorful pictures and tales of seas splitting in two. Most nights he chooses a caterpillar story. He likes to read to us, says Mrs. I can't even pronounce the name, Mrs. Smith, I'll say. I read a sentence and he finishes it. Remember, this child is 3 years old. We have such a good time. As exhausted as I am at night, I look forward to reading with David. Reading to very young children, experts say, can hook them for life on language, books, and learning. And I wanted to stop there. In your school where you teach, somehow through a school newsletter, through personal communication, or whatever it is, we need to continually encourage parents to read to children when they're even before they get to school. Richard Anderson heads the Center of the Study for Reading at the University of Illinois. He and his colleagues reviewed dozens of studies on reading and school performance in which thousands of children from kindergarten to sixth grade and from various ethnic and economic backgrounds were examined nationwide. The report for the National Institute of Education, in the report, for the Institute of National Education, Anderson and his colleagues concluded that those whose parents read to them as preschoolers were likely to do better in school. The study showed they became better readers, have better vocabularies, are better able to understand a teacher's instructions. The evidence is quite firm, says Marilyn Jager Adams, a developmental psychologist who has studied early reading for the Department of Education. If you take the time to explore books with your child, his or her language and school skills will explode enormously. A typical middle-income child, she estimates, already has spent at least 2,000 hours of one-on-one picture book reading, cuddled up with mom or dad for fun and talk. Not only does he or she have a head start on vocabulary and understand the way books work, but the warm atmosphere of closeness between parent and child also helps the youngster develop a positive attitude toward reading. It's interesting to me, in the school where I teach children, wherever I see them, you take a 10-year-old boy or girl, and if I walk up to them, maybe I don't know them, or maybe they're a new student in the school. If I walk up to them and put my hand on their shoulder, and I do that for a reason, it's amazing the response. Some children, most of them, will react positively, maybe lay their head against you. But when I see a child, and I just walk up to them, maybe we're watching somebody play, it's break time or whatever, just walk up, put my hand on their shoulder, some of them will, they jerk away. What does that tell me? Why would a 10-year-old child jerk away when an adult just touches them? What do you think? I mean, what goes through my head? Anybody? He's not used to it. That's one, and maybe worse. Huh? Yeah, he's used to it in the wrong way. And so as soon as he sees an adult reach out, they jerk away. Unfortunately, some parents don't promote reading at home. As a result, their children arrive on the first day of school, not yet primed for learning. Maybe many children have barely seen a book before entering school. How can they compete? And it goes on to talk about different things, and it says, three recent studies of children show that by age three, they score significantly higher than their peers in language skills, social development, and problem solving. By the end of first grade, they also score higher than their classmates on reading and math tests. These early years are critical. And I won't read the rest of it, but it has a little blurb here on how to read to your child. And I just want to read those. It has 10 things to do. How parents read to their children is as important as whether they do it. Remember, how parents read to their children is as important as whether they do it. Here are some methods that really work from State University of New York at Stony Brook. One, choose a picture book with few words. Two, encourage your child to name things by asking questions such as, what is that? Follow the answer with the question, what does a frog do? Repeat what the child says. This is encouraging and lets the child know that he or she is correct. Help your youngster if he or she doesn't know the answer. That's a wagon. Can you say wagon? Praise and encourage. That's number five. Number six, observe your youngster's interest. Talk about what he or she brings up. I'd say that's very important. Seven, ask open-ended questions. What do you see on this page? And that, instead of, particularly if a child has trouble naming things, you can say, what do you see on this page? They may just say words, but at least they can respond positively. Eight, when the child runs out of things to say, add one more piece of information. The giraffe is eating leaves. Number nine, expand on what the child says. If he or she says, duck swim, you can reply, yes, the duck is swimming. And number 10, have fun. I put this on the board. It doesn't show up real good back there. Jesus was a people mover. He took people as they were and pointed them toward home. And we can too. In fact, that is our primary job. In the book of Jeremiah, God gave Jeremiah a message, and he said, I want you to go tell the people. And he gave him the message. And Jeremiah says, well, I don't want to go. They're not going to listen. And God says, your job is to tell them. Whether they listen or not is their problem. And I think as teachers, sometimes we think, and we're not going to move everybody to where we want them to go, but it's our job to do what we know to do. And in a large measure, and depending on how old the child is, it's up to them to do with it what they want. But it's our job to know that we transmit what God expects us to transmit in the way that He expects us to transmit it. Meaning, in a way that it's acceptable to them. And so that verse in Colossians say, delivered us from the power of darkness. Jesus delivered us from the power of darkness. What good did that do you? That's like paying all your bills, but you're still broke and hungry. And He has translated us into the kingdom of His Son. Now, if you look up that word translate, it's metahistano. And one of the meanings of it is to seduce. Now, we think of the word seduce as having a bad connotation. The serpent seduced Eve. He got Eve under his power. But I thought that was neat. That was a powerful word, and I had to think of it when John was talking yesterday afternoon. That's a powerful word. Do you realize that you've been seduced in a good way by Jesus Christ? He's got you under his power. And that's what he does. He rescues us from the devil and seduces us to get into his kingdom. A very powerful lesson. And we need to do that with the children that we have. And there is something natural in children. Isn't it true? Let's say you're a new teacher, first day of school. The children are anxious to like you, aren't they? That's their first, and so you have that going for you. Children have a tendency to look up to their teacher. And so you're entering this thing with a very positive atmosphere. Build on it. It's not uncommon for parents to say, and I'm sure that you have heard them say, a mother tells her daughter something, and the daughter says, what is the daughter likely to say? My teacher says, she's going to argue with her mother. You know, teacher knows more than mother. And that ought to make us aware of the fact that we need to be very careful what teacher says. So Jesus was a people mover, and that's really what we are. This was really reinforced with me a couple years ago. One of my ex-students wrote me a note and said, I was driving down the road, and I was thinking about something, and all of a sudden, I realized that I was thinking about it, what you would think about it. And she said, then I realized how much influence you'd had on my life because you had me thinking the way you think. And so when we're teachers in school, we have a captive audience, and we have a tremendous opportunity to move people, move children, and we have the advantage of having them when they're very, very movable. Now, does anybody want to ask a question, come up and give a book report? I'd do it right now. That'd be great. Thank you.
The book I read was The Lost Gospel Q. I'd like to read two paragraphs from it. The basis of the Q hypothesis, as it is commonly called, is a large amount of material, over 200 verses, found in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. Most scholars do not think that either the author of Matthew or the author of Luke knew the other's gospel. Therefore, the material they share in common cannot be a result of one borrowing from the other, but most come from an earlier written source to which they both had access. That common source was the Lost Gospel Q. By extracting Q from the pages of the traditional Gospels, historians have uncovered a missing link between Judaism and Christianity. In a sense, the lost Gospel Q is pre-Christian. It was later Christians who added the details about Jesus' life and death that became the bedrock of Christian belief. Jesus in the lost Gospel Q is neither Christ nor the Messiah, but rather the last in a long line of Jewish prophets. He is a charismatic teacher, a healer, a simple man filled with the Spirit of God. Jesus is also a sage, the personification of wisdom cast in the tradition of King Solomon. Now, this book I found was entirely false. It does have some interesting paragraphs about the Jewish beliefs, how they were back in Jesus' time. But if you put this into a school's library, because it is false, it will create confusion and doubt in the mind of its reader. And we don't want to do that to our students. We want them to be 100% convinced that Jesus is God, and they want Jesus as Lord of their lives.
Thank you. That's an amazing book, and that's an excellent evaluation of it.
It does not portray Jesus Christ as the Son of God, right? That's the part she read. And they're saying it's some lost, little-known, earlier renditions of the word. I just kind of stumbled onto that book by accident. But it's true. I think the thing is false, and the basic message in it is false. Anybody else? Now, what are you going to do when I start saying, would you sister here in the green checkered dress? Or I may do that. I have some poems. We haven't read any poems so far. And we could probably read poems all day. I think I mentioned to you that I learned my love of this from my father, who could recite many, many poems. And I want to read to you just a few of my favorites. I want to take the time and do that. This one is The Children's Hour. We're going to talk more later on about the to, the into, the through, and the beyond of reading. The into means that you give them some background before you read, either about the author, about the setting, about something, about the reading that you're going to do. So it gives them a jump on understanding what the reading is. And, of course, this would depend on the reading level. Usually with a children's book like Brandon did, you don't need to do that. By the way, before I read this, I want to remind you, like Brandon reading that, see, he could have stopped halfway through and asked you if you were a class. Did he take his teddy bear or not? No, when he was about halfway through that book, how many of you would have thought he's going to end up with his teddy bear? How many of you, well, I guess the rest of you thought he wasn't then. So most of you thought he wasn't going to end up with his teddy bear. When it's all done then, that would be a beyond. You could ask, is there a moral in that story? Is there a message? Maybe not a moral, a message? What's the message? Yes. Be true to yourself. Don't care what others think. You could carry that too far, but in a measure, that's a good that's a virtue, isn't it? I'm not sure there is a bad virtue. What else? Children are basically alike. Mm-hmm. Listen to your father and mother. That would be a powerful message in that. And the corollary would that of that would be, don't listen to are children insecure? I mean, doesn't insecurity run all through that thing? Children are insecure. So whatever makes them secure, they're going to respond to. Here's one written by The Children's Hour, written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And I've wondered many times if there's poets like this today. Longfellow was a man, and I'm giving you some into now before I read this. When I study or when I do something, I don't want the phone to ring. I don't want anybody to bother me. I don't want the door slamming. I want quiet. I read one time a biography of Longfellow, and he said he could do his best thinking when there was children crawling all over him. Now, that's a rare virtue, but apparently he had it, and this poem speaks of that. And think of the way he uses words here. John talked about words, and there's if you look at a college dictionary, it will have this in it. I'll do it bigger. Doesn't write very good. It's mot juste, it's French, and it means the exact right word or phrase. The exact right word or phrase, mot juste, or more juice if you want to, whatever. And you think about it, and that's why a professional writer, now as unprofessional writers or non-professional writers, we have to work at that. We need to look up at a dictionary, we need to think about it. But a professional writer, he gets good at that, and he just, the first time around, he produces out of his mind and experience a mot juste. And that's really what John was talking about. And there's virtually always a better word. And so the nearest you can get to the right word, and we talk about synonyms, don't let children get trapped into the idea that they're technically, in one way, did you know there are no synonyms? No word means exactly what another word means. Exactly. You could take pretty and beautiful. Those would be synonyms. We'd call them synonyms. Do they mean exactly the same thing? Not by a long shot. And yet we call them synonyms. But we need to remember that there are always a better word. Between the dark and the daylight, when the light is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations that is known as the children's hour. I hear in the chamber above me the patter of little feet, the sound of a door that is opened, and voices soft and sweet. From my study I see in the lamplight descending the broad hall stair, grave Alice and laughing Allegra, and Edith with golden hair. A whisper, and then a silence. Yet I know by their merry eyes they are plotting and planning together to take me by surprise. A sudden rush from the stairway, a sudden raid from the hall. By three doors left unguarded, they enter my castle wall. They climb up into my turret, or the arms and back of my chair. If I try to escape, they surround me. They seem to be everywhere. They almost devour me with kisses, their arms about me entwined, till I think of the Bishop of Bingham in his mouse tower on the Rhine. Do you think, O blue-eyed banditti, because you have scaled the wall, such an old mustache as I am is not a match for you all? I have you fast in my fortress and will not let you depart, but put you down into the dungeon in the round tower of my heart. And there I will keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, till the wall shall crumble to ruin and molder in dust away. Tremendous use of words. I just love to read a Longfellow. If you ask me for my favorite scripture, I would be hard put. If you ask me for my favorite poem, if I could only have one poem, and I had to sit in a jail, this would be it. And it has to do with a man by the name of John Greenleaf Whittier. He was a Quaker man. He had a very sensitive spirit. He hated dishonesty. He hated injustice. He hated bigotry of all kinds. And when I think of a poem like this, I've read this poem, I'm sure it's not an exaggeration, 100 times, and it always moves me. And when I think of a poem like this, it's almost, to me, scripture. And I think of it in terms of, if you're ever upset, and I don't know, maybe none of you have ever been upset. Maybe none of you have ever been angry. But I want to tell you something that I learned. You can't read the Bible and stay that way. Try it. If you ever get that way. If you ever get angry, if you ever get upset, if you ever get hurt, whatever, just pick up the Bible, start reading Psalms, start reading the Sermon on the Mount, start reading whatever. You can't read the Bible and stay that way. And the name of this poem is Eternal Goodness. O friends with whom my feet have trod the quiet aisle of prayer, glad witness to your zeal for God and love of man I bear. Now, this would be a poem that would be written, read to high schoolers. And after ever paragraph or two, stanza or two, you could ask them, what's being said? Because poetry condenses meaning. And in a very few words, there's much can be said. I trace your lines of argument, your logic linked and strong. I weigh as one who dreads dissent and fears a doubt is wrong. See, I don't think you're going to read that once and figure out exactly what he's saying. But still my human hands are weak to hold your iron creeds against the words ye bid me speak. My spirit, my heart within me pleads. What's he saying? But still my human hands are weak to hold your iron creeds against the words ye bid me speak. My heart within me pleads. Who fathoms the eternal thought? Who talks of scheme and plan? The Lord is God. He needeth not the poor device of man. I walk with bare, hushed feet the ground. Ye tread with boldness shod. I dare not fix with meet and bound the love and power of God. Ye praise His justice, even such His pitying love I deem. Ye seek a king. I fain would touch the robe that hath no seam. I love that verse. Isn't that tremendous? Isn't that what you'd like to do? Do you think your life would be changed if you had the opportunity, like that woman, if you could just... Ye see the curse which overbroods a world of pain and loss. I hear our Lord's beatitudes and prayer upon a cross. More than your schoolmen teach within, myself, alas, I know. Too dark ye cannot paint the sin, too small the merit show. I bow my forehead to the dust, I veil mine eyes in shame, and urge in trembling self-distrust a prayer without a claim. Thought about that this morning. We had a good night's sleep, had breakfast here among friends. Could you pray to God and say, thank you, God, for giving me my rights. I deserve it all. A prayer without a claim. I see the wrong that round me lies. I feel the guilt within. I hear with groan, travail cries, the world confess its sin. Yet in the maddening maze of things, and tossed by storm and flood, to one fixed trust my spirit clings. I know that God is good. Not mine to look where cherubim and seraphs may not see, but nothing can be good in him which evil is in me. I've studied that verse, and I'm not sure that I understand it yet completely. Not mine to look where cherubim and seraphs may not see. I don't have a right to peek into heaven. But nothing can be good in him which evil is in me. How did he do that? I mean, what was going through this man's mind? Have you ever been inspired to write? I haven't. Anything that profound? The wrong that pains my soul below, I dare not throne above. I know not of his hate. I know his goodness and his love. I dimly guess from blessings known of greater out of sight. And with the chastened psalmist own, his judgments too are right. Isn't that a tremendous two lines? I dimly guess from blessings known of greater out of sight. You know the best is yet to come. We haven't seen the best yet. It's still coming. I long for household voices gone. For vanished smiles I long. But God hath led my dear ones on, and he can do no wrong. I know not what the future hath of marvel or surprise. Assured alone that life and death his mercy underlies. And if my human Heart and flesh are weak to bear an untried pain. The bruised reed he will not break, but strengthen and sustain. No offering of my own I have, not works of faith to prove. I can but give the gifts he gave and plead his love for love. And so beside the silent sea I wait the muffled oar. No harm from him can come to me on ocean or on shore. I know not where his islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. O brothers, if my faith is vain, if hopes like these betray, pray for me that my feet may gain the sure and safer way. And thou, O Lord, by whom are seen thy creatures as they be, forgive me if too much I lean my human heart on thee. Are people writing poetry like that today? Well, they may be. I don't know. I'm not an expert at it. But it seems like in the era of 100 years past, there was more depth to the poetry, the writing, the songs, wasn't there? Is that judgmental? Some people say, well, you just like what's in your culture and what you grew up with. Is that true? Here's one my father quoted. The royal feast was done. The king sought some new sport to banish care, and to his jester cried, "Sir fool, kneel down and make for us a prayer." The jester doffed his cap and bells and stood the mocking court before. They could not see the bitter smile behind the painted smile he wore. He bowed his head, he bent his knee upon the monarch's silken stool. His pleading voice arose, "O Lord, be merciful to me, a fool." No pity, Lord, can change the heart from red with wrong to white as wool. The rod must heal the sin, but Lord, be merciful to me, a fool. 'Tis not by guilt the onward sweep of truth and right, O Lord, we stay. 'Tis by our follies that so long we hold the earth from heaven away. These clumsy feet, still in the mire, go crushing blossoms without end. These hard, well-meaning hands we thrust among the heartstrings of a friend. Do you ever do that? The old-time truth we might have kept, who knows how sharp it pierced and stung. The word we had not sense to say, who knows how grandly it might have rung. Our faults no tenderness should ask, the chastening stripes must cleanse them all. But for our blunders, oh, and shame, before the eyes of heaven we fall. Earth bears no bosom for mistakes. Men crown the knave and scourge the tool that did his will, but thou, O Lord, be merciful to me, a fool. The room was hushed. In silence rose the king and sought his garden cool and walked apart and murmured low, be merciful to me, a fool. Here's one of those poems. Again, it's one my father quoted many times, Little Boy Blue. And children like it. It has about toys in it and everything, but there's a subtle message in it. The little toy dog is covered with dust, but sturdy and staunch he stands. And the little toy soldier is red with rust, but the musket molds in his hands. Time was when the little toy dog was new and the soldier was passing fair. And that was the time when our little boy Blue kissed them and put them there. Now don't you go till I come, he said, and don't you make any noise. So toddling off to his trundle bed, he dreamt of his pretty toys. And as he was dreaming, an angel's song awakened our little boy Blue. Well, the years are many, the years are long, but the little toy friends are true. Usually when I get there, even with a fifth, sixth graders, I'll say, what happened? What happened in that verse? Now don't you go till I come, he said, and don't you make any noise. So toddling off to his trundle bed, he dreamt of his pretty toys. And as he was dreaming, an angel's song awakened our little boy Blue. Well, the years are many and the years are long, but the little toy friends are true. What happened? He died. Ah, faithful to little boy Blue they stand, each in the same old place, awaiting the touch of the little hand, the smile of a little face. And they wonder, as waiting the long years through, in the dust of that little chair, what has become of our little boy Blue since he kissed them and put them there? There's something about meter that speaks to the Spirit. There's something about rhythm that appeals to our heart. And I think God put it there. And I don't know, we can say that the King James Bible is a translation, but isn't it also true that in Hebrew, everything that I have read, there was metering to it. There was rhythm to it. And so he didn't say, blessed is the man that doesn't walk where he shouldn't. That lacks something, doesn't it? But blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. It's metered in the King James, and it's my understanding that it was in the Hebrew. I want to read you one, and tell me what you think of this. This is Carl Sandburg, famous author. And now, some people like this kind of poetry. Maybe you will. The name of this one is Grass. Pile the bodies high at Austerlitz and Waterloo. Shovel them under and let me work. I am the grass. I cover all. And pile them high at Gettysburg and pile them high at Ypres and Verdun. Shovel them under and let me work. 2 years, 10 years, and passengers ask the conductor, what place is this? Where are we now? I am the grass. Let me work. You get it, Linda? I don't either. Yes? Oh, I was thinking about you. Seriously, I didn't know Brandon was going to be here and listen to me. Before I read it, I liked that poem. Now, tell me what it means. I think I know, but... Yeah, what are all those places? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There for supposedly great causes. Mm-hmm. And yet, time and eternity roll on, and the grass represents that. Mm-hmm. And the grass just says, let me work in a year or two, even, or 5 or 10 or 20, 30, people come pass on the train and they say, what place is this? They have no clue of the great things, right, and terrible things that happen.
Right.
And the grass covers it all.
Right. But couldn't that have been said to appeal? Now, maybe that's an adult poem, but you're going to have a tough time, I think, selling that to high school or under, aren't you? Maybe not. But it has a message in it, no question about it. Now, here's one. Anybody know who the Hoosier poet is? Haven't read you any poetry, so I'm taking a little... Anybody know who the Hoosier poet is? You're a Hoosier, Brandon. Who's from Indiana here? Not yet. Who's the Hoosier poet? Right. Basically, I have a little hard time with his poetry, but here's a fantastic one. And it has to do, to me, and this is some into, it has to do with the idea of family, traditions, remembering the smells that went on in grandma's kitchen, all that kind of thing. Is that good for a child to have that? Does that give them security to think about? See, when I was a boy, all I ever remember, I think we only had one thing when we went to my one grandma's, grandpa and grandma's, and she was great at making homemade rolls and chicken and dumpling. And that's what we always ate when we went there. In fact, we would have been disappointed if we didn't. I can remember when they say, we're going to go to grandma's, say, oh, goody. We're going to get some chicken and dumplings. Is that good for a child? Wasn't it pleasant, old brother mine, in those old days of the lost sunshine of youth when the Saturday's chores were through and the Sunday wood in the kitchen too, and we went visiting, me and you, out to old Aunt Mary's. It all comes back so clear today, though I'm as bald as you are gray. Out by the barn lot and down the lane, we patter along in the dust again, as light as the tips of the drops of rain, out to old Aunt Mary's. We crossed the pasture and through the wood, where the old gray snag of the poplar stood, where the hammering redheads hopped awry, and the buzzers raised in the clearing sky, and lulled and circled as we went by, out to old Aunt Mary's. And then in the dust of the road again, the teams we met and the countrymen, and the long highway with sunshine spread as thick as butter on country bread, our cares behind and our hearts before, out to old Aunt Mary's. Why, I see her now in the open door, where the little gourds grew by the sides and o'er, the clapboard roof and her face, ah me, wasn't it good for a boy to see, and wasn't it good for a boy to be, out to old Aunt Mary's. The jelly, the jam, and the marmalade, and the cherry and quince preserve she made. So you could ask a student, now what's the difference between jelly and jam and marmalade and preserves? I have no idea, but it sounds good. And the sweet sour pickles of peach and pear with cinnamon, enema, all things rare. And the more we ate, the more to spare. Out to old Aunt Mary's. And the old spring house and the cool green gloom of the willow trees in the cooler room where the swinging shelves and the crocks were kept, where the cream and the golden languor slept, while the waters gurgled and laughed and wept, out to old Aunt Mary's. And as many a time have you and I, barefoot boys in days gone by, knelt and in tremulous ecstasies dipped our lips into sweets like these. Memory now is on her knees, out to old Aunt Mary's, and oh, my brother, so far away. This is to tell you, she waits today to welcome us. Aunt Mary fell asleep this morning, whispering, tell the boys to come. All is well, out to old Aunt Mary's. And if children learn to appreciate poetry and rhythm when they're young, then they will appreciate it their whole lifetime. I know that's true from my personal experience and experience to others. Is there a message in all of those? Is it possible that knowing poems like that, and we could go on and on, If and Myself, if you can, you know the poem If? We have children memorize it. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. On and on and on. You can change a child's life through literature, through teaching them to appreciate good reading. Here's one, and what I get out of this, a story. Why was people attracted to Jesus? Well, you could make many comments about that, why they were attracted to Jesus. They felt unthreatened by him. They felt security around him. But if you look at the life of Jesus, one other thing that he did, he made people feel important. In other words, he believed in people. You take the woman in John 8, all she'd ever been is put down, put down, put down. Jesus made her feel like she was worth something, that he believed in her. He believed that she was capable of better things. That was a new experience for her. Nobody had ever told her that before. And you look at a child that is been put down, has trouble at home, has trouble with whoever, then that's just a challenge for us. To make them feel important and let them know that we believe in them. I think Jesus would do that. I believe that you can, whatever, and I want to help you do it. And here's the way we're going to do it. A teacher student is not an adversarial relationship. Shouldn't be. It ought to be a reinforcing relationship. Have you told your students, for instance, that you need me, you don't know algebra or whatever you're studying, you need me. I'm important to you in your life. But the flip side of that is you're important to me too. I can learn from you, and I've learned a lot from students. It's not just a one-way street. I need to encourage you. I have an obligation from God to encourage you. You have an obligation to encourage me. We need to work together at this thing. And that's what makes it successful. Now, I'm the teacher. I have separate responsibilities. You're a student. You have special responsibilities. But in the big picture, then we can encourage each other. And sometimes you can call that ego feed. But I don't think so. When I see a student that doesn't properly respond to my encouragement, am I wanting them? Is it because of my ego that I want them to show appreciation for what I've done? No, I want them to show appreciation for them. They need to learn to show appreciation. I don't need it in one way, isn't that true? But in their life, they need to learn to recognize and express appreciation. And ultimately, they need to do that with God. I and Keturah, we were invited to a reception. And Keturah inquired of me, saying, "Which dress shall I wear? Shall it be my new one or my blue one or the one I wore last?" I said, "Let it be the blue one." And she said, "I'll wear all three." For this is our little joke, and her new blue last worn dress looketh good unto me when Keturah hath it on. And I said, "There will be no woman there so fair as thou," for her cheeks were red, and she stepped off as if she were 16. And she said, "O my lord, there is nothing more pleasing unto a woman than to look well in the eyes of the man whom she doth love. Nevertheless, I cannot forget the years or the gray hair which the years have brought. God grant I may always look well in thine eyes." And I said, "Sure thing." And I said, "There was once a prophet named Mohammed, and there are those who think that he was a false prophet, but that concerneth not my story. And he had a wife whose name was Khadijah. And it came to pass after long years that she died. And he despaired of filling her place with any one woman, and he married many wives. And one of them was his favorite, and her name was Aisha. And it came to pass that Aisha inquired of Mohammed, saying, 'Am I not very beautiful?' And he said, 'Yes.' And she inquired, 'Dost thou not love me?' And he answered, 'Yea.' And she said, 'Am I not thy favorite?' And Mohammed looked around and to be sure that none of the other wives were listening and said, 'Yea.'" Now, what do you think happened next? Have you ever read this story? What do you think happened next? She made a mistake.
I'm guessing she's asking for a favor.
That's close. Anybody else have an idea? If Aisha had been wise, she would have stopped there. But there was one question which she wanted to ask more than all, and she made the mistake of asking it. What was it?
"He loves her better than
his..." Right. And she said, "O Mohammed, thou great and noble man, dost thou not love me more than thou didst love Khadijah?" For she grew old and had wrinkles and gray hair, and I'm young and fair. And Mohammed answered with a great oath and said, "Nay, by Allah, for she was the one who first believed in me." I think that is tremendous. When I read this story, I think of my mother. "And I said unto Keturah, though all the fair women in the world were placed in line, and I were led admiring down the length of it, yet would I find no one among them all who would create for me the memories of our struggles and anxieties and economies and our meager triumphs and our sweet and holy joys. Thou in thy new blue last worn dress art unto thy husband the fairest among women." And Keturah said nothing, but she found my hand as we walked away together and she gave it a little squeeze. A lot of messages in a story like that, right? I mean, the love between a husband and wife, and there are all kinds of good things. You could go on forever. And yet, it's an interesting story. You could say you just read that story just for the fun of it. It's kind of funny, and it has some philosophy in it. Do women tend to ask too many questions? No, that's probably a bad one. I don't know. Is that true or not? Well, obviously they can. They did in that story. There is a verse in the Bible, Matthew 13:52. It says, "Every scribe instructed into the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a householder that bringeth forth out of his treasury things new and old." And I didn't know what that verse meant until somebody explained it to me. And it has to do with this thought. And that's why we read the Bible over and over again. That's why I read these poems to myself over and over again many times. And I got piles of poem books at home. I just pick one up and start reading. I read poems that I've already read them many, many times. And that verse says that this householder that bringeth forth out of his treasury things new and old, if you read things that you've already read and you read them with the attitude that I know what's in it, you could pick up John 3 and you say, "Well, I know John 3:16, and I've read that chapter many times, and so why am I reading it again?" But he's saying in this verse, If you read it with that attitude, you won't learn anything. If you read a chapter in a Bible book, whatever, story, thinking that you know everything that it has to say, you've read it, and what's the use of reading it, then you won't learn anything. But if you read it with the attitude, there's something here I've missed before, he's saying, out of this closet, there's something new for you to learn. And since I learned the meaning of that verse, that's been tremendous for me. Never read the Bible thinking you know what's in it, because that puts up a block for you learning what's in it. And we need to do that with our children. Have you ever said, didn't I tell you at the first of the year, or whenever, or last week, or last month? Children need to hear the same thing over and over again. And we say things like, weren't you listening? Well, guess what is the answer to that? Anybody? They weren't listening. You say, well, I was talking and this child wasn't listening. How many times have you listened to a sermon and your mind wandered and you was thinking about something else when he said something, and if somebody would have asked you what he just said, you'd have had to say, I wasn't listening. Isn't that true? That's human beings. So don't get aggravated about that. We need to recognize that that's part of the human experience. And that's why we need to repeat things. And that's a thing that I've struggled with. We do not repeat instructions and lessons enough. And I had this brought to me, and we're a little bit off of reading right now. When a parent, you send homework home with a child, did you ever look at what the instructions are for the homework and think, now, if I were a parent, didn't know anything about what went on at school today, would I understand those? And I have parents say, you know, I read, but I wasn't sure what Johnny was supposed to do. And it made me realize, if you send homework home, and that's what it is, homework, it's not supposed to be done at school, it's supposed to be done at home, then it needs to be very, very clear. So a parent that doesn't have all the background of what went on, because the child isn't going to tell them. I mean, if they get any hint that mom doesn't understand this or dad doesn't understand it, are they going to try to struggle and figure out what it means? No. So it needs to be very clear. Very clear. Now, this whole thing of reading, if a teacher, and I know this is true for me, maybe it's not for you, if you don't set a specific time during the day or the week to read to your children, you won't do it. You can't say, well, if we get through this lesson, or we're going to read on Tuesdays if we have time, or whatever. No, you have to say, on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock, or whenever, maybe it's the last hour of the day or half an hour of the day, on one day a week or 2 days a week, whatever you do. If you don't set a specific time and put a priority on it, you won't read. Unless you're a lot different than I am. I don't know how many times I've said, I'm going to read to the children. And first thing I know, a week's gone by and I haven't done it. But when I set a time and say, we're going to do it. We're going to stop whatever we're doing. We're going to do it. Then you'll do it. One more thing, and then we will take a break. In time past, we alluded to this fact the other day, and I'm thinking now about what are the hindrances to children reading and loving good reading. And we are in a battle with the devil for the child's heart. Now, that may sound a little bit harsh, but I think if we think about it, I would feel very strong about that. That we are in a battle in our day and age, and it's more open than it has ever been for a child's heart. There are many, many things to pull a child away from good things, whatever they are. And I'm not saying only the good things are reading, but certainly that is one of them. For one thing is the plethora of bad things to read that's before them all the time. All you have to do is go to the grocery store. It is amazing where our society has come. We don't realize it because it takes on gradual. But I got to thinking about that one day, and this to show how different it is When I was a teenage boy, if I would have wanted to seen any, I don't even remember thinking about it because it wasn't even a subject. I probably didn't know what the word pornography meant when I was a teenage boy. Nobody ever used those kind of words. If I'd have wanted to see any, I'd have had no idea where to go find it. It wasn't available. It wasn't around. It wasn't even an issue. Well, what's today? You got to walk around with one eye closed in a grocery store. That's how far it's come. And I think we are in the front line as a teacher, certainly as a parent and a mother. We are in the front lines in this battle for a child's heart. And so it takes extra measures. You can't just assume that these things are going to happen automatic. Whatever ingenuity, creativity, imagination God has given you, you have to bring everything you have to bear on this contest to win this contest for a child's heart. Isn't that really what we're after? If you can hook them on learning, if you can hook them on anything good, then the child can handle life. He's on his way home. And that's very real to me. If you start listing the things that we're in competition with, and I'll tell you what really got me thinking about this. I went and heard a minister speak, and he talked about, it was to a group of ministers, and I can't remember now whether there was 500 of them there, Barbara, down in Fresno, hundreds of them, ministers. He said, when a person comes to your church, how many churches do they pass to get there? You ever think about that? I've thought about that many times. Now, we don't have very far, so we don't pass very many. But when we was in Ohio and went to church in Ohio, we had, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles to go. I'm sure we passed 12 or 15 churches to go where we was going. Why did we do that? I mean, why are we driving all that distance when we passed all these churches? In fact, he pointed out in the world, and we're not talking about possibly our kind of churches, but it might affect us more than you think. He said, why should a man or a woman leave the comfort of the soft chair in their living room with iced tea right at hand and even get out of their chair when they can turn on the TV and hear an excellent sermon? And he was a minister, a Nazarene minister, and he said one Sunday morning after he'd preached what he thought was a great sermon, he's standing at the back and one of his parishioners walked past him and said, hey, HB, did you hear Charles Stanley this morning? And it's the same way, and that got me thinking about, so as ministers, we are in competition, and we don't like to use that word, but we are in competition for people's attention, for people's hearts, for people's spirit. And it's the same token we are with childs. You got stiff competition, don't you? I mean, am I overstating this case? You got stiff competition. It's pretty hard to make a book roar like a three-wheeler, isn't it? That takes some doing. There's just something about the noise that boys like. Isn't that true? I mean, the more noise, the better. Well, books don't make noise, do they? And you could go on and on and on. So think about, I would be pleased, I would consider it a success, at least today, if you would just think about, what am I going to do in this battle for a child's heart to get their attention and pulling them away? Now, you're saying a three-wheeler is a devil's tool? Well, that's a little harsh, isn't it? Is that quite right? I don't know. What do you think? You're not thinking?
No, it's a lot of fun.
What?
No, it's a lot of fun.
No, it's a lot of fun. Yeah. So, you know, you don't want to, but still, you're in competition with that kind of thing because that's what they want to spend their spare time at. So it's probably a little harsh to say that's a devil's tool, and yet it's pulling them away from good. And I remember the minister years and years ago made this statement. And I want you to think about this, and then we're going to take a break. And then Grace Struber is going to be here and read for us. Thank you. What's the next word?
Best.
Good is the enemy of the best. Think about that. So you can do a lot of good things and neglect the best. Now, you know, I don't do that, but I see other people doing it. Let's take a break. I think it was 1992, right? Grace at Faith. We did a literature class. And it would be one way to say it, that I was a teacher and there were four students, but really there were five students. Grace Brenneman, at that time, was one of them. And the other one was Rosie Atkinson and Sharon Kurtz and Chris Kipfer. And I've been involved in a lot of classes, but I'll never forget that one. And in that class, one thing we did is we had students read, and that's, if we was doing this for a 6 week, there's a lot of things we could do that we can't do now. And I remember Grace is going to share what she read. One of them, I don't remember who, read part of The Yearling. How many of you have read The Yearling? And they got to the chapter, one chapter ends where his father tells him, this pet deer he has, take it out and shoot it. And so everybody wants to know then what happened, but you don't read the rest of it, you let them read it. Chris, I remember it was, read out of Les Miserables about the Mansour, and I can't say that the way she said it. I tried very hard and never made it. And that's a tremendous chapter. And I don't remember what the other one was. So I asked Grace to come and share her reading today. So here she is.
The chapter that I'm going to read is from the book called Good Old Archibald. I got to know about the book from one of my friends that I taught school with, and her mom had a copy of it, so I would borrow the copy and read it to my school students. The book is centered around an upcoming ball game with these fifth and sixth graders, and there was a new boy that came to school. His name was Archibald, who was not very well liked because he took Ralph Jackson's seat, and Ralph Jackson was a good ball player. So the preceding chapters are telling sort of about how they can keep this guy, Archibald, from wanting to play in the big game, and they just were sort of tired of him bugging around. And as the book goes on, you can sort of see how the boys' hearts are changing just a little bit, and by the end of the book, they do accept him. So maybe you'll see it just in this one little chapter that I'm going to read. Just a few things about relationships among children and some lessons that you can learn. It's not necessarily a Christian book, but I think there's things we can learn from it. The chapter is called Everyone Participates. On Thursday, we counted days, and Wilmer said, "The big game is 1 week from Tuesday. We will have to do some better pitching and batting and catching." "Right," said Harley. "My cousin goes to school in Lawson. He said their best batter can bat a ball into the sky, and Victor Valley can pitch a shutout. My cousin says we will have to go some to beat the Lawson Lions this year." "Okay," I said, "less talk and more action. First batter," Harley said. Just then, we saw Archibald coming. "Wait a minute," I said. "Here comes Archibald. Archibald, I suppose you are going to observe?" "I feel I have observed almost long enough," Archibald said. He did not have a ball, but he pretended to wind up and pitch. "I feel I am about ready to participate in the game." "Participate." Wilmer moaned a terrible moan, but before he could think of anything to say, Archibald was talking again. "However," Archibald said, "first things first. The spelldown is tomorrow evening. I have a suggestion. I think we should spend recess practicing spelling." This
was the most horrible idea we ever heard. It was bad enough to have to practice spelling at home every night, but Wanda and Glenora and Susie and the girls agree with Archibald. The sixth grade had never been beaten by the fifth grade, Wanda said, but I have heard that four of the fifth grade boys and all the fifth grade girls get 100 in spelling every day. Well, Archibald was the only sixth grade boy who got 100 every day, although sometimes the rest of us got 100. We are going down to the corner of the playground to have a spell down, Susie said. Wanda will pronounce the word. Every loyal sixth grader will come. I am a loyal sixth grader, I said, but I will not come. The game with the Lawson Lions is only 12 days away. Which is more important in life, Wanda asked, to be a good speller or to be a good baseball player? You just asked Miss Kramer. Well, I said, you just asked the Lawson Lions. Then I had a better idea. Ask Archibald, I said. So Archibald had his chance, and what did he say? Both are important, he said, but the spell down is coming first. Wilmer thought of something. Archibald, he said, we need good baseball players, but we need good spellers too. So we're going to be big about this. We will not be mad if you go and practice spelling instead of baseball. A fine idea, I said. I am sure good old Ralph would feel that we were doing the right thing. So Archibald went with the girls. Harley batted first, and Wilmer pitched. Strike one, Wilmer yelled. That was not a strike, Hardy said. That was a ball, and you know it. You swung, Wilmer said. He hit the ball again. Strike two, he yelled. That was a ball, Hardy said. Strike two, Wilmer yelled again. He wound up and sent the ball. It was only a ball. Strike three, he yelled. You're out. Hardy showed all his teeth, and it was not a smile. I'll show you, Hardy yelled. And then we saw Miss Kramer coming with 13 girls. And Archibald. Boys, Miss Kramer said, Wilmer, Trenton, all of you, Hardy, come here. Wanda had a perfectly wonderful idea, and I am disappointed that you turned it down. Wanda thinks you should spend recesses practicing spelling, and so do I. Come on, line up. So that was the horrible way we had to spend recesses. And we do. It was Archibald's idea. At noon, I said, I do not think I care to speak to sixth graders who are not loyal to the sixth grade. That goes for all the girls. Goes for Archibald, too, Wilmer said. After this, we will make no reply to remarks made by those persons. So, we had a spell down during every recess Thursday and Friday, but we did not speak to the girls and Archibald. Miss Kramer! Wanda said, the boys will not speak to us. Miss Kramer smiled. Well, that's just fine. You may write anything you wish to say, and they may reply in writing. And since I am a girl, they may write to me too, and they can better spell all the words right. So we had to write every single thing we wanted to say to Miss Kramer. We had to write, may I sharpen a pencil? And may I get a library book? I wrote, I forgot my gymnasium shoes. May I borrow my brother's? And I'll just dump right up here how you feel.
Just erase
Miss Kramer would not answer me, and I had to look up gymnasium and then write it 10 times. I had never done so much writing before, and neither had the other fellows. Archibald wrote me a note, you can kiss it, which I did not answer. He wrote, Dear Trent, don't be angry at me. When the spell down is over, I shall be glad to participate in the ball game. This may sound unbelievable, but I can bat straight and hard, and I can pitch a curve or a straight ball. We will beat Lawson. Yay! participate. The girls kept writing notes to us too. Wanda drew some hearts on her nose. To me, she wrote, Trent, aren't you sorry you were so stubborn? That did not look right to me. So I looked up stubborn, and I found that Wanda did not know how to spell it. I wrote her a note. Please learn to spell before you write to me and before you participate in the spell now. I did not put any hearts on it. But Wanda drew some hearts on it and put it in her pocket. The spell down was in the gym on Friday night. The fifth grade was lined up on one side and the sixth grade on the other. All the parents were sitting between us. Miss Kramer and Miss Honeychurch were up in front, dressed up and smiling and smiling. Miss Remington, the fourth grade teacher, pronounced the word. Poor old Wilmer had bad luck. He was the very first guy to be spelled down. His word was horizon, and he spelled it H-O-R-I-Z-Z-O-N. When he sat down, he grinned at me and whispered, "My pitch." Next, Miss Honeychurch's smartest girl, Priscilla Trask, had very bad luck. Her word was dictionary, and she spelled it D-I-C-T-I-O-N-E-R-Y. Then she had to go and cry. I know! But nerves do not count in a spell down. The next one down was Hardy's dear cousin, Susie Scott. Susie cried too. She said she did not hear the word very well. That did not count. She was out. Some more fifth graders went down, and then Hardy put two B's in neighbor. Gorgeous Lenora was looking at Hardy through her eyelashes, and that is why she went down. She spelled going with a W. G-O-W. She really did know better. Shannon felt right, and soon there were only four sixth graders and four fifth graders left. The next hard word was disappoint, and that was Wanda's bad luck. She had on a yellow dress and had yellow bows in her hair, and when she sat down, she kind of flipped her skirt and winked fast, but she did not cry. The next hard word was disappointment, and soon only Shannon and Archibald and I were left. Now, the I is Trent, so Trent and Archibald are here in sixth grade, and Shannon is the fifth grade brother. Archibald spelled judgment, Shannon spelled weird, Wilmer moaned. This could go on all night. We could smell coffee and see two ladies cutting pies in the kitchen. I spelled happily, and Archibald spelled desperate. Archibald's Aunt Grace was smiling at Archibald. Ma and Pa were smiling at all of us. Wanda and Glenora were smiling at Archibald, I hoped, although some of their smiles went sideways. Miss Kramer looked very proud, and Miss Honeychurch was smiling at her dear, dear Shannon. Shannon was working very hard. He is a better speller than I am. And if I missed, I would be glad to see him win. But I had to do my best for the sixth grade. We spelled eight words. Then Shannon got unbelievable. The poor guy missed it. He spelled it U-N-B-L-E-A-V-A-B-L-E. He was all mixed up. He had never spelled it that way before, and I knew that he knew better. I had to spell it right for Miss Kramer and the sixth grade. Then the sixth grade had won, but we still had to see who was the winner, Archibald or I. The next word was participate. Archibald spelled it P-A-R-T-I-C-A-P-A-T-E. My ears almost fell off. Wrong, said Miss Remington. Archibald shook his head and grinned and sat down. His Aunt Grace kept smiling, but I thought she looked very surprised. Pa and Ma were smiling at me too, but I knew what I knew. Are those notes still going around? I think participated on one of those notes. I took a big gulp of air and spelled it P-A-R-T-I-C-C-I-T-A. There was a very loud moan from several people. Wrong, Miss Remington said. Trenton J. Conway Jr., Mom said. You can spell that word that night. That was last night, I said. Then one of the ones had to stand up. He could spell it this morning, she said. I have this little note to prove it. She took my note out of her pocket, and it had all those little hearts. Was my face red? I did not want everyone to think that I am mushy. I showed it to Miss Remington and said, please don't let anyone see you. Why? Miss Remington said, I think we have a boy here who did not want to spell his friend down. Everyone began to clap. Well, I am a very honest guy. I knew that Archibald tried to let me win after he was sure that the sixth grade had won. I had his note in my pocket with participate spelled right. I took it to Miss Remington. She looked at it and laughed. What a very fine friendship we have here. Two friends who refuse to spell each other down. My pa spoke up. I suspect that these heroes were getting hungry and decided to tie it up, which proves that they each have a good nose for banana pie. So it was a tie, and everyone clapped. They made Shannon stand up, and they clapped for him, too. The prize was a big box of candy, which we passed to everyone, and then it was time to eat. Well, Wilmer said afterward, Archibald was a hero again. I suppose Miss Kramer will say we have to let him play and spoil the Bumblebee's chances with the Lawson Lions. Party moaned. I wish good old Ralph had not moved away. Good old Ralph would not have been a hero. He would have been the first guy to be spelled down. Good old Ralph could not spell cat, but he could play ball. Well, I said, Archibald thinks he is ready to participate. Participate, Wilmer said. Archibald will come around to your house tomorrow, Trent, and want to bat. You have to hide out somewhere, or all the bumblebees will be very mad at you.
I don't know how many times I've heard that, and if she wanted to do it again, I'd listen. Janice, how many times have you heard it? Boy, there is so many lessons in a story like that that you could go on and on, right? But the thing to me about that is, and that's inspired me, any of you could do that, couldn't you? Would any of you stand up? I'm not going to ask you to, but would any of you stand up and say, couldn't do it? You could do it if you wanted to, couldn't you? We see Grace do it, and I've heard her do it I don't know how many times. But that's not easy for her. I mean, I talk to her, and I know her very well. See, I had to sort of talk her into doing it. So, getting children interested in reading is our challenge. You now know how to do it. You just have to do it. Isn't that right? A lot of things, that passing around the notes and the whole thing. Of course, when you have a smaller class, that's a lot easier to do. If you read that one chapter, would even the boys want to read the rest of the book? Why would they want to read the rest of the book? Who wins the ball game? And so you see, this thing of sports in America is no new thing, is it? Been around a while, pretty deep rooted. Any of you have any comments on that? What she just did, or anything? Before I forget that, A Stranger for Christmas, you didn't bring that book, whoever has it? You might bring it. Somebody wanted the author of that. Now, does anybody want to give a critique on their book? Okay, thank you.
This book is called Warden of Yale, and I, out of the two books that I had, this one looked a little more boring, so I thought, well, I'll read it first and get it over with. But I've come to the conclusion that it's actually the more exciting book of the two. It's about a young man who is wealthy, and it has his devotion to God and the depth of his Christianity was really because of his mother. It says, it was his childhood experiences and relationships that produced godly character in his life, making him a pure vessel fit for the master's use. And this is kind of the hero that you would read about in Grace Livingston Hill. His college mottos were, "Wherewith shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed thereto according to thy word." Psalm 119:9. "And thy word have I hid in mine heart that I might not sin against thee." Psalm 119:11. He was a very real Christian. And this one we had up here about the last quote, this poem kind of has a lot to do with that. Says, "God has his best things for the few who dare to stand the test. God has a second best for those who will not have his best. I want in this short life of mine as much as may be pressed of service true to God and men. Help me to have thy best." Now, these aren't poems that he wrote, but they're just scattered throughout this book, and it's very, very inspiring. This was my favorite one. "It takes great strength to bring your life up square with your accepted thought and hold it there. It is so easy to drift back, to sink, so hard to live abreast of what you think." And when I tried to decide what grade level this was, the first time it came out to 8.9, the second time it came out to 13. So I would encourage you to do it a couple of times, because this would be probably hard reading for a young person.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.